There is a halfway mark between the known and unknown. A middle ground or chamber where divine wisdom and truth reside. In this middle chamber, we will explore and expose the ruling paradigms of social engineering, mind control, government conspiracies, and cover-ups. Join us as we navigate the territories and boundaries of natural law and the ancient principles of the sacred feminine and divine masculine. Examine and consider alternative energy systems, holistic healing arts, and wild soulful living to train our awareness in a most novel and abstract manner to view reality from an entirely new perspective. Welcome to the Middle Chamber.
We're talking about Pepsi Cola and Nestle. You guys all heard about that? The new, what's running around on the internet, the story about Nestle and Pepsi using fetal matter for flavor enhancement research. Right. So when we first heard that, we were like, what are they talking about? Is this like, are they putting fetal matter into foods? And our good friend Freeman Fly, he did a little bit of research too. He's like our Snopes agent. He went out there and tried to get the real story, and he came back to us and said, you know, they say flavor enhancement flavor enhancement research, that's like they're actually cloning stem cells and turning them into taste buds and then testing their food on these cloned taste buds. It's gross.
That's
so freaky gross. And the stockholders of the company, they tried to sue the company to get them to stop doing it. And the company went to the SEC and got them to override the stockholders and say this is standard, you know, business practice. This is what we do. You know, we can't have this. We can't have them taking on extra costs like to do something else besides this research. It's completely fine. It's okay. There's nothing to see here, everybody. Just go about your business. So, anyways, I want to thank everybody for showing up. And we wanted to have this event, which is like the inaugurating event of the first DVD from the Free Your Mind Conference last year in Philadelphia. It was Free Your Mind 2, so it was a Free Your Mind 1. That's how I got involved in this whole radio thing, because Freeman, a good friend of ours, he had a show on AFR called Free Zone. And three years ago, he wanted to go to a Free Your Mind Conference, so he asked me to sit in as his guest host for about 8 weeks. So I did an 8-week stint, and that turned into a 3-year stint on American Freedom Radio, which is used to be right here in Austin. I guess it still is in Austin, but different management, I guess, at this point. So I was broadcasting for 3 years up to and beyond the 2012 apocalypse knot. Right, the apocalypse that was not. So anyways, good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and I wanted to also thank my wife, Mrs. X over here. All her help and support for this all going on. She's my co-host on the new version of the show, which is, we've got flyers if anybody needs them up here, but this is the new show hosted by Fairfax and Matrix. So it's kind of like an old 30s socialite breakfast show with a husband and wife sitting at the table talking about what's in the New Yorker or something. The truther version of that, I guess, is what we'd say. But we're really having a fun time, you know, just trying to make light of heavy topics, you know. I mean, for me, 10 years of wandering around America trying to figure out, like, what is the spirit of our times, you know. Like, I was in search of the American zeitgeist. What are we doing? Where do I come from? Where am I going, you know? Who am I, you know? What is this all about, this whole consumerism rat race thing we're doing? Along the way, I think because I, like I'm sure many of you, were not satisfied with what the authorities were presenting to me. You know, that started really early for me. When I was in school, I quickly realized that the teachers were full of it, that they were just reading out of the book, that they didn't even actually have any real critical thing, or, you know, some of them did, let's be fair, some of them were critical thinkers, but a lot of them were just reading out of the book. And if you challenge them, they would just all fall apart. So my mission in life was to go find other material and bring it in and challenge the curriculum. And so that quickly got me labeled as a problem. You know, and at first I got in trouble all the time. I got sent to the office constantly, kicked out of classes forever and all this stuff. But after a while, I gave up that struggle and just sat in the back of the room with like five or six of my own books and just read quietly. And they were happy to just leave me to read quietly because I wasn't disturbing the class anymore, you know. And I was passed like that year after year, with incomplete, straight ups across the board. And my parents were like, what's going on? They get a report card, straight ups, but he passed, you know, because they just wanted to push me through. I suffered with the psychological effect of feeling like I'm an outsider. You know, everybody else seems to go along with this, and they're all doing this, and they're happy to embrace this, whatever we're doing, this, you know, indoctrination is all I could think of. And then I read a book by a man named John Taylor Gatto called Underground History of American Education. That book made me weep tears of validation because I realized that what they're really training you in public schools is three things. Show up on time, right? Don't be tardy. That's like a moral issue. You know, you just better not be. My kids who go to public school today, they'll get really upset about being late, like emotionally upset about it, because they're being trained to show up on time. The second thing you learn is obey your teacher, supervisor, manager, instructor, keeper. Obey, obedience. You know, do what they say, no matter what they say. Third thing you learn is do some mindless, rote, useless activity until the bell rings, and then walk away. Don't take anything with you. Make like it never happened. And so those three things, I challenge you to show me any regular public school where that's not really what they're teaching in the curriculum, because in the end of the day, what do you have? You have a good little industrial worker or a soldier from that. And it's more elaborate than that, obviously. This is the subject of the talk that I gave, The Secret War on Human Consciousness, is about looking at how they limit our possibility, looking at how they limit our potential. It's all about limiting the potential for what you believe is plausible. If we keep you in a narrow bandwidth scope of what's plausible, then you won't ever try to go outside the box and think about that, and you definitely won't question whatever we tell you we want you to do, if it's inhumane or if it destroys the environment or if it's otherwise nasty in any way. You'll do it because you're geared to obey. So, anyways, that's what started me on this road a long time ago, and traveled all around, read a lot of books, tried to challenge the people around me, and most of the time, for many years, it seemed like nobody wanted to hear anything I had to say. Most people would just be like, oh God, here it comes again, oh my God, really? And I think maybe some of you relate to that. I mean, yeah. It's like your family and friends or whatever, they're just like, not again, really, I just want to eat my meal, you know what I mean? I just want to watch my TV show or whatever, just leave me alone, I don't want to think. So it was kind of, you know, you develop a chip on your shoulder, right? After a while, you start thinking, what's wrong with me or them or something? What's wrong with all this? And so validating now, because time has passed and people are sort of like, you know, the things that I thought no one would ever come up to me and ask questions about, people are very interested in, like the fallen angels, the Nephilim, the, you know, the secret societies, and what's really all this about? Where are these fraternal orders in the American history, you know, and world history? What's really going on? Most people could care less 15 years ago when I'd be talking about the Freemasons, or the Knights Templar, or the global power elite in general, the dark occult and mystics, whatever you wanted to say. No, nobody really even thought that they exist, let alone would want to care to even discuss the finer details. Our humble host and hostess, we've been talking all day about these different subjects, these type of things you can hear on any one of these internet radio shows, you know, from coast to coast, to Clyde Lewis or Freeman Flatley or the Middle Chamber. And, you know, we're looking at these subjects that are steadily becoming what I would call like the curriculum of the truther movement, you know, per se, and postmodern thing. So that's what we're going to talk about tonight a little bit. So anyways, like I said, good evening. I want to thank Harlan and Ryan and staff here at Brave New Books for having us. I also want to thank Freeman Fly and Jamie Henshaw for their friendship and help and support. You don't have to have to applaud all these, but anyway, thank a few other people here too. But I'm going to thank also Mark Passio and Michael Falsetto, because they're the brains and the passion behind the Free Your Mind Conference project. And, you know, if they hadn't allowed me to become part of that 2 years ago, well, then I wouldn't have had the DVD that I've had made to show you all. And to well, it's available. We're not going to actually show it. But basically, the idea is these DVDs, you know, these are available. You can even watch the online. But by purchasing this DVD, you're actually, this is a fundraising device for our media endeavors. What we want to do is continue to present more and more stuff. And so these DVDs and other media projects, books and magazines, are all part of the method to do that. So it's pretty simple, self-explanatory. So I wanted to thank them for helping me to be a part of this. And I wanted to thank all the listeners and supporters over the last few years, all over the world, that have listened to my show and have helped to make all of this happen, really, keep it going, and give me encouragement, too, many times, to keep going. And that's been a big part of all this, so to feel like you're reaching somebody. Is anybody listening? Are they, you know, they going to give you feedback? They going to say to you, wow, you know, I didn't even think about that, or hey, have you thought of this, or have you looked at, so many people have told me things and brought me things that I didn't even, you know, made more depth, given more depth to all this, so that's been exciting as well. So, the Middle Chambers, like I said, has been broadcasting weekly, right up into and beyond 2012 and the great apocalypse that wasn't. And of course, we had John Michael Greer, author on, who had a book called Apocalypse Not, where he talked about, he broke down how the cataclysm meme that we carry around in our genetic database, which we'll get into that a little bit maybe, a little more, but right now, I mean, it's like we basically expect some sort of cataclysm every 1,000 years or so. Like, it's just culturally removed towards everybody kind of anticipating it, whether it happens or not. What's that all about? It's programmed into us. It's part of our, you know, genetic makeup, as it were. So, right now, I want everybody to applause yourselves for showing up. Thank you. So, all right. Let's see. So, this is the launch of first, hopefully, many DVDs that we're going to map out all these themes that we're talking about and we've been talking about for a long time. And I'm sure many of you, if not most of you here, are aware that there is a secret war on human consciousness. It's going on. All you got to do is watch TV, news, movies, listen to music. A war of information, a war of thoughts and feelings, as well as a battlefield of open hostilities towards all life on Earth, really. And all humans, like you and me, I assume, and all the rest of Earth, you know, Earthlings and all the life on the planet. And that's what we've been talking about on the radio, is this secret war on consciousness in various forms, and mapping out the various forms in which they manifest in our everyday lives. So, I got a show called The Middle Chamber, you might have heard of it. My wife, Mater X, and I, we host the show, and please come check us out sometime. We're now on the SyncBook Radio Network, which is thesyncbook.com. Or syncbookpress.com. Saturday nights, 9 p.m., we release a new podcast. The last one we did was really good. We had Ross Penn, whose book is called Mystic Philadelphia, or his DVD is called Mystic Philadelphia. And he talked about the ancient mound builders, the Native Americans, and the giant races of man that existed in America, turns out, for thousands of years. Huh. Everybody knew that, too, in the 19th century. Even Abraham Lincoln gave a speech once about giants peering at the Niagara Falls and how it was clear that the ruins all over America were, the remains were all giant remains. Because in the 1840s, they were digging giant bodies up all over and saying, what the heck are these? And then all of a sudden, like, the Smithsonian Institute would show up, cart it all up in a box, and like the Raiders of the Lost Ark pushing into that room with all the other unmarked boxes and be like, oh, we don't know where it went, it's gone. And they, all the stuff just vanished. Hundreds and hundreds of remains and photos and, there was a museum in Catalina Island that had, for all the way up until the 30s, I think the Ridley family owned it, where they had dug up something like 5,000 giant remains out of Catalina Island off the coast of LA, and they had built a museum and like where you could buy pieces of giant bones in the gift shop. And you know, it was like 500 photos, boxes and boxes of remains. They shut it all down in the 30s and carted it all off to the Smithsonian, never to be seen again. There was one giant that was found in Indiana that was 18 feet tall, and he had a 9-foot long iron sword and a helmet. and he was dug up in Indiana, right on the border, I think, of Indiana and Ohio. Again, hundreds of town people came and viewed it, pictures were taken, Smithsonian showed up, and it disappeared. And it just keeps happening over and over again. So, anyways, this is the information war. You know, this is just one example of one little front. You know, look at the media. We hear about this awful shooting, this recent awful shooting. We were driving here from up north, and you can hear the story progressing in the media as we're driving, as the hours are passing. They're dropping the little hints and planting the little seeds of how they're going to sculpt it. You know, it's like, oh, first it was like, well, we're not clear. He might be on some sort of medications. They quickly changed that. And then it's like, you know, he had some sort of altercation with some coworkers, you know, other soldiers. That became the main focus. Now that's really the version they're giving everybody. Oh, it was just a personal dispute that ended poorly, you know, and that's all. And nothing to see here, everybody. You know, go back about your business. Don't forget to take your medication on the way out the door. You know, and so the wheels keep turning. So the way we start the show every week is we say, or I say this myself, I used to have it in my intro, there is a halfway mark between the known and unknown, a middle ground or a chamber, where divine truth and wisdom reside. And each week we explore the boundaries of and view reality from an entirely different perspective. So stop by and check us out sometime. So the information war rages on, a war of perception being waged by bankster, thug, dark, occulted, global corporate elite against the rest of us on the planet, animals, fish, bugs, air, water, everybody's susceptible. We're all collateral damage, all of us. But what are the weapons? You know, besides the chemical, alchemical, and financial weapons there are, there's also the knowledge and information is the weapon, and the sculpting of information, and the commodifying and the consensus that's formed, especially with the internet. The internet's a perfect way to create consensual reality that we all share, we won't question because we're just too busy. There's more stuff to look at. We'll just file that. And even if you don't believe it, if you see something and you file it as a memory with an emotion attached to it, even if you disagreed when you first saw it, later on when you see it, it's recalled as a memory with an emotion attached to it that has validity now because it's real in your mind. You've actually committed some neural pathways to this thought. So it's like formed physical reality in your brain, even if it's not true. That's how our society works. Civic mythology, it's continually presented to us over and over again, George Washington, cherry tree, or whatever, anything you want to hear, any of those stories, or how about that, you know, Pearl Harbor was a surprise attack. You know what I mean? Like, these kind of things are civic mythology that have helped to create, as we all know, this is something that helps to create the reality. We're listening to an old tape of Robert Anton Wilson talking about general semantics. And he was talking about how language sculpts reality. And that's what the whole process of general semantics by Alfred Korzybski, written back in 1933. It's a book that's like 900 pages of like scientific language, basically describing how we use words to construct reality and how to not fall prey to our own problem of consciousness, which is that we are quantumly entangled in this. So like Einstein said, you can't solve the problems of consciousness with consciousness because you're in it. You know what I mean? It's like trying to wash off mud with muddy water. It just keeps getting muddy. It's never going to happen, you know? So how do we step outside of that? How do we get to a place where we can see beyond? And that's what the ancients, before this whole, you know, I don't know, this whole party we got going now started, ancient people understood that too. You know, they understood that there's a greater reality beyond this reality. And that greater reality is the key to, you know, rich inner lives for you and me, all of us. Because without that essential part, life seems a little bit stale, or we're missing something. Is this all it really is? Is this the best we can come up with? Like, I asked the question again. And the reality is that, no, in fact, there is more to life, but we have been conditioned to view only this much of the potential of what's possible, the narrow bandwidth of what's possible. We're told 90% of our brain matter is junk, right? The DNA junk. Oh, it's just useless stuff, it's just side stuff. Really? Because I don't know anything else in nature that's junk. Nature doesn't produce junk. Maybe what it is this is the rest of the brain that's been shut down. This is like we're on safe mode, you know, like a computer. We crashed, now we're on just safe mode, only the basic applications and platforms running. There's a whole other stuff. We could do all kinds of other stuff. once we get the system running again. But we really can only run these operating systems right now because it crashed. You gotta be careful. So, we must aspire to be more than brute work and pack animals, servants to the elite, because the truth, illumination, self-knowledge will set us all free. Know thyself and know the mysteries of the universe. You know, that was above the Temple of Delphi, the words of Thales. So what I've concluded from decades now of research is that we are living in the wake of an aftermath of a species-wide hijacking of consciousness. That some 10 to 13,000 years ago, give or take a millennia, one or more earth-shattering event horizon catastrophes effectively knocked humanity's collective network of consciousness, as well as every individual consciousness, offline. And this created, in effect, a post-traumatic stress-disordered species. In such a weakened state, the human species was ripe for exploitation. It was ripe for harvest, ripe for enslavement. Enter a pathogen, a mind virus infestation of whatever source, either inner or outer species. It doesn't really matter where this thing came from, but it matters that this predator, this pathogen, brought, if you know that term from Robert Heinlein, understood, brought the terra incognita of the human mindscape and understood how easily we are manipulated by fear. Fear is huge. Fear is the mind killer, right? It's the hugest way to manipulate somebody. We see that right now in all the false flag events that go on in our culture today are all fear-driven psyops that will lead us towards the pen where we're supposed to go, you know, be sorted. So, collective consciousness of humanity, you know, it was knocked offline with that cataclysm, and then, like I said, it brought back online in this veritable safe mode. And this collective disorder diverted enough of humanity away from the tribal hunter-gatherer subsistence existence to the city-state agriculture accumulation existence. And existence whose authority was justified by a select priesthood chosen for obedience and skill in perpetuating the ruling paradigm, reinforced by military might, of course, the might of the state, whether it be a dictator or a republic, it neither made then any difference, nor does it make any difference now. It simply is a matter of control through force and control through authority, the authority that's handed down by the priesthood, whether it be the bankers, the financial advisors, or the doctors, or the AMA, or the, you know, PhD holders, or whoever it is. It's all the authority. They get to tell you what it's like. You know, if they say it's possible, it's possible. Otherwise, let's move on to something else. So, okay. The wasteland is formed. What then is the wasteland? It is a land where myth is patterned by authority, not emerging from life, where there's no poet's eye to see, no adventure to be lived, where all is set for all, forever, utopia. Joseph Campbell said that in Creative Mythology in 1959. And Campbell was a true mythologist, like John Lamb Lash, author of Not in His Image. Both men were writer researchers, inspired visionary mystics who saw and see beyond the veils that our minds weave to perceive reality through to that greater reality that exists, a greater reality beyond this narrow bandwidth. And these are the visionaries that we are inspired by, those who see beyond, you know. Eventually, you know, at some point along the way, in the early formation of this new pattern of humanity that came after the cataclysm, eventually out of the steppes of what we call now ancient Persia or Iran, thousands of years ago, still thousands of years before now, but not quite as far back as 13,000 years, two schools of thought arose, two approaches to esoteric knowledge, employing what we might call the mystery traditions of the universal laws of consciousness. Some people, like the seven natural laws are used, you know, the book called the Kabbalion talks a lot about this. So there was the two schools. The Illuminators was one school, Illuminators. These were people who were fosters, like P-H-O-S-T. They were, as in phosphorescent light, they were light guides or way showers. These were people who would basically instruct the initiates into ways of liberation, to full integration and self-actualization. While the other school, the Illuminati school, captivated and entrapped and enslaved its adherents, bound to false realities or dead-end rabbit holes or cul-de-sacs of awareness, what the Greek Gnostics called the stereoma, which is like simulated inorganic chaos, depicted as a counterclock reality. Something that seems real, very convincingly real, but it's not. And I think we all know, you know, which one the masters of this world prefer us to be indulging in. And in one of the various forms or another, these schools traveled all the way down through history, first to the Dark Ages and Crusades, and then to the Renaissance with Michelangelo and Leonardo, and then to the Enlightenment with Voltaire and John Locke and Thomas Paine and Jefferson and Franklin and all the other boys, you know. And what they did was they crafted and built their own conception of a Republican utopia, some well-intentioned, maybe, yes, many others not so well-intentioned. And, you know, altogether, these men of the Enlightenment, they embraced the forbidden wisdom, the forbidden fruit that was the what they called the occult sciences or the hermetic arts, which had long been suppressed by the Holy Roman Church. So they were still extant, though, in Western consciousness, even though they, you know, you were punishable by death if you were to practice or even unpack these things and look at them. They were still there. We perceive, long before I realized that we, anybody else in the room, was descended from Europeans like me. So our people were conquered 1,000 years before the Plains Indians in the same way. You know, it just happened in Europe. The European tribes were the same as the Plains. I've done a lot of research to show a lot of those people were living the same way as they were living here, but that interfered with the plans of the Vatican and the church, you know, and there was a lot of important steps that had to be taken to prevent the continuation of such frivolous existence. It's very unproductive. So the founding fathers, they understood that there was something powerful about this knowledge that had been forbidden. They understood that it invoked some powerful feelings in humanity. You know, so they wanted to capture that feeling. They wanted the citizenry of America to associate. When they looked at certain things, they wanted to associate with greatness. So they used pyramids and porticos and columns and obelisks and all these archways and emulating the Greeks and the Romans and the Egyptians as ways of inspiring people, invoking that feeling of thinking about America the way we think about humanity. It's this potential for greatness. You know, it goes back to a golden age when we were building pyramids and the seven wonders of the world and all the stuff that we're capable of. So America's in that same progression, see? See, go down to D.C., those structures that don't look like Egypt, it's the same thing, really. We're just moving forward. So they employed those devices. They used all the symbols they could. And it worked for them, you know, it really did. Not so well for a lot of other people, but empire moves forward. So we know the founders employed geomancy. They employed earth magic, as well as, you know, not coincidentally choosing, our first podcast coming back on the internet was last week, and we had Ross Ben, whose research is from, it's called Mystic Philadelphia, and he studies the ancient tribes and the mound builders and the colonial Rosicrucians from the ancient Philadelphia waterway region. And it turns out that it's not just a coincidence that they chose Philadelphia as the spot, the birthplace for the revolution and the birthplace for the nation. Where the waterways cross in the old town of Philly, the legendary tribes of the Lenape, of the Algonquin nation, they occupied what was they thought to be the most sacred spot on earth. And that's where the hill that Rocky runs up, you know, in that movie, he's like, yeah, you know, Rocky, that's the hill, that's the mound, that's the most sacred spot on earth, according to the Lenape. And they said that anything that was done there, anything that was commenced in this spot, has the full participation of the earth. That's what they believe. And that's where they founded Philadelphia. That's where they founded, that's where they read the Declaration of Independence. It was right on that spot. So they got the full participation of the earth. I mean, no wonder America expanded as much as it did, right? I mean, I guess so, in a way, right? But maybe not, because, I mean, I don't know whether the earth really would want to participate in all this, frankly. Not now, not with what we're talking about. I don't know, maybe I'm wrong. I can't think for the earth. But from where I sit, it looks like we're doing a lot of damage to the earth. So, and all the while, empire is driven on the backs of the masses of oppressed and enslaved people who roll in and give us your tired, your poor, your huddled masses. We'll feed them right into the meat grinder. Yeah. You know, that's how it goes, right? So, on that very same spot, they also did the Articles of Confederation. So, the start of the American government started right there. It was conceived, and again, with the full participation of the earth. Sacred spots. I've heard a legend once that when the Revolution ended, George Washington walked down through the streets of New York City right after the Revolution ended, and he walked to a spot down by the water where a little ancient chapel was, and stood on the same sacred spot as observed by the natives before the colonization of that spot. So there was like a temple or some sacred thing that they had there, a mound or whatever. Now it was New York City and they had a chapel, and it was like the 18th century. So he goes down to this little chapel, legend says. Washington goes into the chapel, kneels down, and he prays to the divine creator to bless their endeavor, you know, to have a free nation, or a nation free from tyranny is how the legend goes, right? So that exact spot is ground zero of the World Trade Center bombings. It's the same exact spot. So think about that. So, you know, I don't know if you've ever read this book. There's a book out, it's called The Most Dangerous Book in the World. I can't remember the author's name. Does anybody know that? I couldn't recall his name, but in this book, he explores the possibility of what I would call quasi-Masonic black magic rituals being worked during 9/11 attack. And I mean, he breaks down the plaza. I mean, the symbolism is amazing. Down to like the 47th problem of Euclid on one of the buildings, and you know, the Solomon Brothers building is the one with the 47th problem. I mean, it's amazing the correlative parallels between the way he maps this out, the possibility that, you know, what a great way to undo that endeavor. You know, what a great way to twist that endeavor and say, take it to another level, you know, about tyranny and freedom. And if you were a dark and cold and mystic, I think that would be a great opportunity, really, if you had the means. So, right on that same exact spot, this blows my mind. It's worth checking out that book, though. I would recommend it. And I mean, for the record, I'll just be honest, he does get many smaller details a little bit off, you know, but of course, as an uninitiated, he's not a member of the Freemasonic fraternity, he hasn't been exposed to all these rituals, but so he doesn't have, it's not surprising he would get some things wrong because he doesn't have the exposure to it, you know, he doesn't experience the data that you can get from it. So, but it's just an interesting aside, you know. I mean,
the most dangerous book in the world.
The most dangerous book in the world. Dark geomancy, you know? So I mentioned John Taylor Gatto, right? He wrote a book called Underground History of American Education. But he also wrote another little book. It's real small. I don't even think it's like 100 pages. It's called Dumbing Us Down. And in this book, he speculates, and this is a mind blower when I think about this. He speculates in this book that colonial America at the time of the Revolution, at least among the non-slave classes, was nearly complete literacy. 100%, he says. Near 100% amongst the non-slave classes. And now let that sink in for a minute, okay? 100% literacy. He also says that among the slave classes, it was 75% literate. This is his claim. You know, he's a 35-year veteran, New York State School Teacher of the Year. He has a long history of educator and all this stuff. So he's come up with this information, but it's just a mind blow. We know literacy had to be high, right? We know it had to be high because we know that Thomas Paine sold 600,000 copies of Common Sense to 3 million colonists. So you do the math there. That's a high percentage of people. And, you know, the war was fought, right, with the words from these pamphleteers like Thomas Paine. They were the bloggers of the 18th century, you know?
Yeah.
And they printed them out on this new thing called a printing press, you know, or it wasn't new that time, but it was the accessibility of the common man was pretty new practice, you know? So 300,000 copies, or 600,000 copies of 3 million colonists. That's a high percent. And the idea is that, you know, they didn't just one person read it and drop it, they passed it on. You know, not everybody bought a copy, so other people got free copies. So you think about the numbers of people that were reading. And then, anybody ever read Common Sense? That book, let me tell you, it's no light reading. This is not James Patterson or Judith Krantz. You know, this is, and this was a pamphlet here that was sold on the streets of the colonies. I mean, talk about the standard of literacy, even the definition of it. I tried to figure out the literacy rate in America right now. It's really hard to do. I don't know if anybody's got better luck at this, but I couldn't even get like a qualified definition of literacy based on the modern quantification and qualification. Because, see, what they call literate now is just reading instructions. If you can put together a barbecue, you're literate. That's not what I call literacy. I call literacy reading the material, putting it down, and then discussing it with somebody else in a cogent, lucid manner, conveying the information that you just read. That's literacy, you know? And by those standards, I mean, I found some guesses that say that the literacy that we just mentioned, the one where about reading instructions, is about 40-45% in America right now. So, and it would be even less if we talked about it as a standard of literacy based on the time of the revolution. So 40-45% of the general population of America is literate based on a standard that's below the 75% of the slave classes that were literate back in the revolutionary times. So we're literally at half the rate of literacy, which is a lower level of the standard of literacy, than the slaves were in the revolution. And if you ask Mark Passio, my good friend, he's from whatonearthishappening.com, brilliant man. If you ask Mark Passio, he'll tell you that less than 2% of the American population fought the revolution and won it. That 80% of the population were Tories who wanted the British to stay in charge. So only 20% were even ideologically in favor of the revolution. And only 2% of them actually fought it and won and took the power away from the tyranny. Those are crazy numbers. I don't know if that's true or not, but I tend to believe Mark because he's a pretty smart guy. He wouldn't say something with such conviction if he didn't really have some data to back it up. But I'll tell you, that really, really says a lot about, you know, I mean, all I got to say is, if you're going to read books like Common Sense or whatever, you better bring a thesaurus. I mean, I'm not just saying, like, I needed the thesaurus. You know, like, and I read a lot, and I still felt like there were so many concepts being put forth in these books that, like, bring us beyond these instructional literacy levels that we're taught. This is literacy in America. And we think, oh boy, we're always progressing, we're always moving forward. No, I actually think we're probably more likely moving backwards in the devolution state, not evolution, but. So self-knowledge, critical thinking are so key to true freedom and liberty. Is it no wonder that Liber, the word, comes from liberty, which means book, right? Knowledge is power and freedom. And don't believe the pre-sorting, limiting, categorizing society standards, the processes that tell you that, you know, all through human beings are, wait a second, I lost my train of thought on this. Okay, so human beings, or better yet, human becomings, have more potential for pure, brilliant art and creativity and real genius than any IQ test could ever aspire to measure. And that's the beauty and the hope of humanity, as far as I'm concerned. I was watching an old video of Terrence McKenna's. It was from the 80s. And he was sitting, he just got done breaking down, like, basically the secret one of human consciousness, just like in his words, you know? And it's basically what I'm talking about in this video. And so he's just sitting in this black and white video, and it's like at like Esalon Institute or something, and he's talking, and he just gets done, he's gone on a little rant, he's just looking out at the audience, you know? And it's real quiet and still, and somebody in the audience says, okay, so what's the answer, man? Like, what's the cure? What do we do, right? And without a blink, without a hesitation, he fires right back at them. Art. Art. Art and creativity is the answer. Joy and abandon. Novelty. That's our only hope. And he's right. He really is. Because see, the power elite, the evil alien mind parasites feeding off humanity's collective consciousness, they can't relate to novelty and humor. They just can't. They can't relate to that frivolous abandon. You know, that people will just like, they can't comprehend or control frivolous abandon. What the Gnostics would call luminous epinoia, which is creative visualization and imagination from within. This is what remains the hope of humanity. Art, music, joy, love, novelty. You see, a control meme was established a long time ago, whereby catastrophe was commandeered and utilized to coerce humanity through fear into routine patterns of mediocrity, steeped in a narrow bandwidth of sensory materialism. Authority overtook free will, and consciousness control went into effect. Communication always plays a pivotal role in constructing and maintaining control paradigms. Now, we experience, how we experience and how we relate to the world around us, this is all sculpted through communication, you know, through media. Multimedia in our modern age has ushered in all of us into a new age, a new level of virtual reality and thought control. Misdirection alone works to effectively distract and divert the American psyche from a true state of reality so that we might adhere instead to a classic romantic notion of being a stranger in a strange land. The existential angst of supposed and perceived separation and disconnection from the vast, active, living intelligence system, as Philip K. Dick called it, I like that, that surrounds and connects us all to a higher level of consciousness, a divine awareness, if you want to call it that, or just whatever, a greater mind, a cosmic self. And it's all in spite of the veiled deceptions that are woven around our awareness every single day. In spite of all that, consciousness still bleeds through. It still shows through the veil. True consciousness. And for me, my personal grail quest was clear. I needed, in my own self, to restore my own psyche, which had been warped and twisted many lifetimes ago, probably, in one cultural control meme after another, you know? I had to reconstruct, reconnect, recover, restore both the sacred feminine and masculine, the creative mind of the universe, the indwelling spirit within all of us, however we want to perceive it. We have all been so thoroughly indoctrinated and imprinted with teachings and outlooks from what we could call the Abrahamic religious memes, to use a term, which on the most fundamental level are elaborate thought-stopping control systems, which is the case, I think, with most religious memes, because religion, from the Latin, religare, means a couple of things. It depends on who you turn to for your translation, but in one translation, it means to bind back or to tie back, like in horticulture, to tie back something so it'll only grow so far. That's what religare means. But it also means to bring back around or restore to a former traditional self. That's also what religare means. So there's two different versions, depending, again, the Illuminators or the Illuminatis, you know, total captivity and entrapment or self-actualization and fulfillment, you know, whatever. It's just all about the intention. So, all right, so in the end, I believe there are thousands, millions, probably billions of paths up the mountaintop. And in the last words of the Buddha, doubt and find your own light. Because that's what he said when he died. He's, you know, he's laying on the bed dying, and he's got all of his followers, you know, the Buddha, the Eightfold Path, the Four Noble Truths, this whole school of Buddhism, and everybody's following and believing and worshiping the Buddha. But when he dies, the last thing he says to everybody is doubt and find your own light. Like, get the hell out of here. Go, you know, get a job or something. Go, see, you know, live life. Go do something. Don't follow me. I've got my own way. I don't, you know, I really like that because he was, it's really wisdom. We're supposed to create our own religion. You know, each one of us. We all have our own path up the mountaintop. Nobody else can tell you what truth is. You have to experience that for yourself. People can suggest things. They can lead you. They can elude you. You know, they can show you a way, but you gotta walk it, right? That's what we all have to walk that path. The philosopher and mystic John Nash describes what our species suffers from. It's an acute desacralization, the removal of and the devaluation of the sacred element of our everyday life, the everyday collective, the collective and the individual awareness brought together, as well as the more sublime states of consciousness that we reach through meditation or entheogens, as your choice may be. So dystopian discord locks us into routine, predictable patterns of behavior which are easier to control. So the DVD that we're here to promote and to release tonight maps a revised military history of America as a series of false flag events designed to maintain a psychic lock of control on its own citizens while forming an economic empire fueled by war and endless warfare. So in the Sync Book 2, which is also here, chapter 8 is my essay on synchronicity and how synchronicity and synchromysticism could be connected with gnosis. It's an essay, a philosophical consideration, how the two could come together, cosmic consciousness, this principle of sync, which was presented in Sync Book 1, which basically is defined as the discovery of convergent archetypal symbols in pop culture, acting as the very undercurrent of divine awareness, personified through the myriad processes and symbols that make up the building blocks of reality. So through a combination of, you know, just like everyday things, you ever walk into a house and you hear a song on the radio and there's a little phrase, and the phone rings and you pick it up and somebody says the same phrase, and then you turn on the TV and it's the same phrase, and then somehow that phrase comes up later on and you find the significance later and you're like, oh, wait a second, hey, like, what was that all about? You know, and you start kind of pondering that. And maybe there's a little sync going on there. If we paid more attention, we could see more what the universe is trying to say to us, you know? So I'm actually offering the possibility that, you know, the universe would speak to you through multimedia, through little tidbits and sound bites, you know? I mean, call me crazy, but I actually believe that could be happening. let's see. So through a combination of this and by contemplating the animation of the material and sensory world, moving into deep rapport with the mysterious sources of all life itself, towards what Lash proposes as a biomysticism for the empathic and visionary participation in the life force. I know it sounds a little new agey, you know? I mean, it does. But there's really something to this. I think there's something to the idea of re-sacralizing, bringing the sacred back into our reality, something that we've lost along the way. So I think that when you think about the people who can't get out of bed in the morning without popping a mood elevator or something like that, I mean, the existential reality for people today is there's something missing. They can't get out of bed because the rich inner life they might be experiencing is not there. And why? You know, maybe because it got shut down when they're in safe mode, you know? That's what I would propose. So gnosis, it's from this perspective. The method of direct access to the physics of the cosmos through the instrument of the body, the senses, or the biophysics of perception, according to Wilhelm Reich, Austrian genius, Wilhelm Reich. By infusing our imaginations with sacred elements, we can restore mythical and mystical patterns, frequency, vibrations of human experience to our reality. I often tell people and my children the difference between boredom and depression and joy and freedom is a rich inner life. You know, cultivate a rich inner life and you'll never be bored. You'll never be depressed. So cultivate that within yourself through higher knowledge, through greater understanding, through critical thinking, through true ineffable or unspeakable, indescribable reality. However that may be for you, you know, however you define that. So this year, Freeman and I were launching a new media project called Conspiracy Science Theater, which will be a vehicle for the Middle Chamber video series. And among other things, it's gonna be great. We're gonna do like little sketch, it's like a variety show with little short segments that we're gonna kind of weave together with a theme each show. It'll be from different media providers. It's kind of sort of like retro, going back to like old Kids in the Hall maybe type shows or something, but all like around, you know, the subjects that we all seem obsessed with. So that's the new show that we're working on. So in the first video, we'll be exploring the symbolic and actual parallels between corporations and government logos and quasi-Masonic symbolism. I say quasi-Masonic symbolism because, in case anyone doesn't know, there's up to about 800 to 1,200 different other side orders that can be connected to Freemasonry, in that the members of these orders have to be Freemasons before they can join. So it doesn't mean these orders are Masonic. It means their membership is Masonic. But the order itself could have completely different intentions or expressed mission statements. And you only would even know they exist when they tap you to join. It could only have like 20 members worldwide, but those members could all be billionaires, you know, and they could be very influential and powerful people. So think about that, 800 to 1200 different orders all connected to Freemasonry. So that's why I use the term quasi-Masonic Freemasonry, because I think a lot of times these other orders that have all the same tools and the same design as the order of Freemasonry, but with different intentions and different specific mission, whatever it is. So these quasi-Masonic symbolism, think about this. There was a report that was put up by SRI, the Stanford Research Institute, from 1970, the year I was born, which mapped out the awakening of American society, that we were headed for collectively a great awakening that was going to occur. And it was going to be around the time of 9/11, 2001 to, you know, like 2012 or 2015. That's what they said in this report in 1970. And the report was to the government, they suggested certain things that we as a people could be carefully and strategically, preemptively herded ideologically using Masonic Egyptian iconography and symbolism to captivate the American social awareness. And this all goes back to the founding fathers again, see? Because they had the full participation of the earth. And they employed dark geomancy. And they wove in the cult principles to it all with specific intentions. So, you know, the idea that later on, a couple hundred years later, this another new branch of the government decides, hey, you know, we could take those seeds that were planted a couple hundred years ago in the civic mythology of America, we could kind of use that to our advantage. We could lead people down a different road, and the road being one maybe of false flag control. So this was a report that's, you can look this up, this 1970 report. I first heard about it from Lynn Picknett, who wrote The Stargate Conspiracy, which is another good book to read. So, lost, forgotten, and suppressed knowledge still exists out there. And intellectual dumpster divers like myself and Mater X and Freeman and Jamie and Mark Passio and scores of others like you guys out here, we're all intellectual dumpster divers. You know, so we go in there and we find that stuff that nobody else wants to look at, the remnants and review the pertinent insights to the mechanics of things that we peer behind the curtains and look at the man turning the wheels and the knobs and report back to everybody else, right? Because that's what we do. We're drawn to that. People like me, you, if you're one of those people. So I'm working on a new article right now for Paranoia Magazine, which is out of San Diego. And I'll be speaking at the Paranoia Conference April 2nd and 3rd this summer. And there are actually a few copies of Paranoia. August 2nd and 3rd. We have a few copies of the article I wrote for the winter issue. The fall issue, which is the one with it's the JFK issue. I got in the 50th anniversary of the JFK issue. That's awesome. I love that. I'm writing a new article. And in the new article, we're talking about, it's going to be, the title is Fallen Angels, Giants, Monsters, and Dark Occult Mystics in America. Sounds exciting, right? Hopefully we're going to make a DVD of that one too, you know, so maybe something in a year to come. But. So, what we're going to do is we're going to explore some of the same stuff I'm talking about here. We're going to talk about the giants. There's so much information about the giants and the mountain builders and the ancient tribal peoples and just the different stuff that's been going on. Like, okay, there's one more thing on the table. Okay, yeah. So this is an obscure reference. Everybody knows who Aleister Crowley is, right? So he has this book called The Confessions of Aleister Crowley. And in this book, while he was touring America right after World War I, on page 68, he says that his quote from the book, my first stop, this is in like 1920, my first stop was in Detroit, where Parke Davis, which is the pharmaceutical company that makes like Benadryl, okay? So my first stop was in Detroit, where Parke Davis was charming enough to show me all over their wonderful chemical works. They had installed countless and ingenious devices for conducting the processes involved in manufacture by machinery. Many of these produced effects and exquisite beauty of a land till then dreamed of in my philosophies only. A great mass of pills in a highly polished and rapidly revolving receiver was infinitely fascinating to watch. And they were kind enough to interest themselves in my research in anhalonium lewi, which is a peyote extract. So Crowley was actually feeding this peyote extract to his adherents and disciples. to like help in his like controlling of their minds probably, but he said that they made him some special preparations at Park Davis, which were greatly superior to my own preparations. That's just remarkable to me. I mean, like, what? Like, I read that, and I'm like, what does that mean? I mean, what whatever else that was going on there, and like, what? How did he get access to that place? And I mean, it just blows my mind when you think about Park Davis today and Benadryl and all. I have suffered greatly with allergies, and I eat too much of Park Davis products at times, let me tell you. So, that's just a little aside. That's the kind of thing I'm going to be bringing up in my articles coming up. So here it is. Everything we know is wrong, everyone. Our world is under a vast enchantment, right? It's an iron grip of sensory materialism, conditioned experience, so-called scientific observation. Two words for scientific observation. Quantum entanglement. You know? That's my two words for it. Ha! you can't escape the problems of consciousness with consciousness. So we must retrain our eyes and our minds to view the greater reality, to see through the false realities of false flag events which are being shaped by cybernetic social engineering and mind control programs, transhumanist dystopias, multimedia virtual realities managed by a breakaway predatory society, foisted upon the paradigm of closed energy systems and artificial scarcity and shortages. It's basically a rationalist nightmare where humanity's worth is measured by the hour and by the dollar. And the invisible causes of life are relegated to myth, legend, and fantasy. But all hope is not lost, really. I don't think it is, to be certain. I mean, here we are all tonight, right? On a Friday night. So consciousness and reality are interwoven in an intimate interaction with an energetic, holographic, hydraulic multiverse. So our bodies, each one of us, little cell quantum processors, downloading our customized operating system from the supreme divine network administrator. And within the quantum entanglement, the admin fabricates material existence upon a canvas of space-time, using coagulated light, photons, and dark matter as its paint. And that's how we all exist in this reality, as far as this vision, right? Max Egan from theprohouse.com, he suggests that conscious intelligence, cosmic or otherwise, transmits hydraulically through the universe, on through the medium of water, because hydrogen, being the original atom, original particle, original piece of matter, hence the global focus on water control and alchemical manipulation of water supplies and sources. Max posits that when one's bodily vehicle finally expires and degrades, its 60 to 70% water content is expelled and recollected by the Gaian Earth matrix, effectively uploading the sum total of our individual experiences back to the source of all consciousness. In effect, a network upgrade with everybody passing away, with each time a person passes away. I like that idea, actually. So we must relearn how to relate to each other in our world. Too long have we participated in the genocide and enslavement of our own species, all the while indentured by fear and coercion. So I say, let us go forth from here and learn to creatively overcome adversity, all the while realizing the sacred in every day. And when we encounter suffering and struggle, opposition, resistance, and fear, we will persist until resolution, harmony, balance, integration, and transcendence follows. Listening to the universe speak to our minds in sync. And I usually end things with this, tat tavam asi, which means thou art that. And I'd say one more thing, that non-compliance through artistic expression, everyone. Thank you very much.
Interesting.
Isn't that cool? That was
Max Egan.
I wish I could take
credit
for that. Interesting
to think about.
Yeah, he's a great guy. Have you ever heard of him?
Max Egan?
Yeah. Prohouse.com. He's out of Australia, right? I've had him on my shows before, a couple years ago. But
that is really, really heady. I mean, that's something to really think about.
Yeah, I liked it. I mean, I've been quoting it ever since. He told me that like 3 years ago, and I can't stop thinking about it.
Very interesting.
So.
I have another question.
Okay.
So, to the Masonic end of the world. So, Catholics can't be Masons?
Yeah, they can.
Okay.
I mean, there are different times in history, different popes have banned them. Started with like Pope Ignatius, I think, was the first one. But it's been reversed and put forward again and again, like Pope John Paul kind of semi-reverted it. And then Benedict like fully turned it the other way. And now I've heard that Francis is, I don't know, is he going the other way again? It's like swinging back and forth constantly from Pope to Pope. But in the end, Catholics, like, how do I say it? It's like, I was raised a Catholic, so I'm Irish Catholic, right? Catholics don't practice Catholicism. Most of them don't. I mean, they really don't. I know. We don't read the Bible. Never. When I was being raised as a Catholic, we never read the Bible. I read the Bible when I was 18 years old for the first time.
That is Catholicism.
That's Catholicism. You let the Father tell you. The Father tells you from the pulpit. You don't read the Bible. He tells you how it is.
Right.
That's the way it always is, even in modern day. So Catholics, it's like, in many ways, Catholics is like Judaism in the sense that they qualify. I'm a Catholic. I don't even have to practice Catholicism. I was born a Catholic. That's the way a lot of Judaic people are, the same way. So it's like, the point is that Catholics do whatever they want, you know, just because a pope, one particular pope might forbid people from being a part of Freemasonry. Catholics will do what benefits them.
So from the Mason Catholics are cool?
From the Mason side? Yeah, the only thing you're going to run into is that Masons are prominently Protestant. So you have that, like, you know, the normal prejudice between Protestant and Catholics will sometimes surface. Because Masonry really started as a form of Protestant mysticism. Because before Masonry, all the material that's in Masonry was forbidden to look at. So you could die if you looked at it. The Inquisition could show up, kill you and your family for reviewing this material, right? So when the King of England, King Henry VIII, kicked out the Catholics, made himself the head of the Church of England, it opened the door to allow everyday Protestants to have access to holy orders, the mysticism of holy orders that was only exclusively in like the Dominicans or the Benedictines or the Jesuits. Mm-hmm. Now it became, there was a need to have a place where people could freely exchange the ideas that were mystical and not fear the Inquisition or Turcomata, you know. So that's where Freemasonry, in the best intended way, I think, started as a Protestant form of mysticism, but it was taken and derailed in different directions. Yes.
I'm sorry, I arrived here late intentionally, but you may have already mentioned this, but a little bit ago you mentioned the intention of the founders as related to dark geomancy.
Yeah.
What is it you were saying was the intention of the founders?
Well, we did a podcast last week on my show, The Middle Chamber, my wife and I, and we interviewed Ross Benz, who's got some research called Mystic Philadelphia. And he's done the research on the mound builders, the ancient Algonquins, and the colonial Rosicrucians who founded the Philadelphia waterway regions around Old Town Philly. And there are like seven or eight ley lines that all crisscross right on the very spot where the Declaration of Independence was read and the Articles of Confederation were drawn up. And this very spot, it's the hill that Rocky runs up the steps of in that movie Rocky, and he jumps over.
Right, okay. Now I wasn't aware of that before I heard you mention it. Yeah. But I'm wondering, but what were the specific intentions of the founders?
Okay, well, I was getting to that. So the Lenape had this mound, the Mystic Mound, that is Mystic Hill in Philadelphia from the movie. That was the most sacred spot on the earth, according to the ancient Lenape. In that spot, they had their sacred mound, and anything that was commenced there, according to the Lenape, was supposed to have the full participation of the earth. So the mound builders, the mound gritters, as Ross Ben calls them, the Philadelphians who came and settled the area, they tricked the Lenape out of that by, according to him, murdering Chief Tammany's wife, who was the grandmother of Lenape's, who had all the control over whether they could have that land. Mm-hmm. And she wasn't letting them have it. So they murdered her, and they got Tammany to work with them. Tammany means easy to talk to. His name means easy to talk to. And so that he was the Tammany Hall from New York. There's a statue of Tammany. Uh-huh. He was the Lenape chief who basically traded away the sacred land of the Lenapes to Ben Franklin and the Philadelphians. And Ben Franklin actually broke the deal that gave William Penn, Pennsylvania, the nomenclature, because he was the one who sat down and broke the deal. So Ross Ben's contention, and I would agree with him here, is that those grid builders knew about this ahead of time. They already possessed knowledge about geomancy, about sacred power energy spots, probably from Europe, you know, British Isles and stuff like that. And they chose that spot because they commenced the nation building of America on that spot with the full participation of the earth. Okay. And the reason why I refer to it as dark geomancy is because of the results.
Yeah, that's interesting. because can it be dark? In other words, the whole concept of geomancy is positive in the sense that it is of the earth and such. And how can it be supporting anything that is bad that you're doing? In other words, it sounded like a conspiracy on the part of the founders. And,
yeah, I would say that's the accusation, is that it would be a conspiracy on the part of the founders. I see what you're saying, and I can totally relate to your position. What you're trying to say is that if it's of the earth, it's good. It's of nature, it's good. It's not dark, it's not bad. But, I mean, death is of nature. That's bad for somebody who cares about somebody who dies. And shadow is part of, I mean, like, you know, Isaiah 49:7.
Well, I'm not taking a position. I'm not taking a position.
No, what I'm saying is
I see all that as a positive thing, you know, but if you use it for positive purposes, it's positive.
Sure.
Can I offer something?
My particular take on it?
Maybe like, because that spot was so sacred and because whatever was done there with the full participation of the earth, whoever, I think maybe what you might be trying to say is that they understood that if they were to bind, somehow capture the power of the earth, they could bend it to their own will and
it
would just happen with their own intent. I mean, there's magic in this world, and it's neither black nor white. It's who is practicing the magic and what their intention with the magic is. So the power of the earth can be guided, maybe, to a specific purpose.
That's pretty much
what I'm saying. Like any technology can be used.
Sure.
Any technology can be used for good, and it could also be used for good.
Well, you know, we always hear that this country was founded under God and such, and the perception by most people is that makes it a Christian country, so to speak. But the founders were not necessarily Christians. They were deists, correct?
Yeah, sure.
They were all Freemasons, correct?
No. There was only a percentage. I mean, there was only 14.
Well, true, persons. Yeah, right. But that's a false perception, isn't it?
What's the false perception?
Well, I mean, there are no Christian symbols in Washington, D.C. It's all pagan or...
Now you're on a slippery slope, because I can sit here and debate with you all day long about how all the Christian symbols are really pagan symbols anyways.
Well, I'm not denying that either, right. Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah.
But, you know, but I think I see what you're trying to get to here, you know, and like, I'm not trying to disqualify it, and what you didn't miss when I was qualifying this to begin with was I said many with good intentions, but also many with not so good intentions were amongst the founding fathers. So inevitably what you have is, you know, in any group, right? I mean, there's going to be small percentage. There are going to be psychopaths. I mean, in any group, there's going to be at least a couple people.
One out of 25.
Yeah, right. So I mean, so the
margin.
I knew that was the next question. I'm right up here. So the point is, though, is that, you know, intention is really the key. The working definition of magic is to cause change in accordance with will. To cause change in accordance with will. That's it. So whether it's dark or white, black or white, it all is about intention, you know? And so I would say, yes, I really believe, what you did miss in the beginning was I talked about how they were trying to invoke the expansive image of humanity's potential, its achievement, you know, by building temple-like structures with corticals and columns and archways and pyramids and obelisks. They were trying to invoke that golden age of humanity when we built pyramids and the seven wonders of the world and look at how much we can accomplish, because they wanted the average passerby to look at the monument and think, America is great. We're part of that same line. It goes all the way back to the antiquities of like what we can accomplish. That was their goal. And I don't think that's a bad thing per se for any people to want their own people to have pride. No, that's not a bad thing. But I guess I would just question some of the specifics of some of the individuals. And so I would say that it's been presented to me quite convincingly that there was some malfeasance afoot, I would say, in the intentions of those who drew up the blueprints of our early nation.
Well, there's really, if you look at the history that we're not taught, you know, the Articles of Confederation could not be altered without 100% support of the states at the time. The mandate given by Congress at the time to the group that went into the convention that created the Constitution, well, that's not at all what they were supposed to be doing.
Sure.
They went behind secret doors and they produced a document and they called it We the People.
Yeah.
But, you know, the word people was capitalized, which makes it a proper noun, which means that we're talking about specific people, and that means not us.
Right.
And the founders talked about how all men are created equal. Well, not all men did they treat equally. I mean, Thomas Jefferson himself had slaves. He had children by slaves.
Sure.
You know, I mean, there's a lot of contradictions there. And look at where we are now.
But,
he talks about what a great document the Constitution was, but it's because of the Constitution we're in the shape we're in right now.
Sure. I mean, I think that the Articles of Confederation, frankly, were a better
set. You've read them?
I have a copy of them.
Right.
So the Federalist Papers.
I rarely run into anybody who's ever read the Articles of Confederation.
So I think that they do have, I wanted to say something. You said, you know, all the full participation of the states, right? But of course, the Revolution I mentioned earlier, how many people were in favor of the British being overthrown? The majority of the people were Tories in America.
Well, they were all Englishmen to begin
That's
with.
That's right.
Yeah.
And then the ones who wanted America to prevail, only 2% of them actually fought the Revolution.
Right.
So the very smallest minority of America overthrew the English tyranny.
Well, exactly. Even at the time, the average person did not have the right to vote. There was no suffrage. To vote at that time,
you
had to be a property owner or have a certain level of wealth.
Yep.
Otherwise, you meant nothing. And that's what I'm saying. This was not, and the people that fought, well, they were fighting for something that they themselves stood to lose.
Yeah.
You see what I'm saying?
Yes. And they, they put their own fortunes and their own destiny on the line for it, as we know. Question.
Well, kind of along those same lines, so what is the ultimate goal with America, with the founders and with presumably the Freemasons who perhaps continue to run America? And like she said, with magic is neither good nor bad. The same with Freemasonry, it's neither good nor bad, right?
Sure.
But my take on things is that, kind of like you said, there seems to be malfeasance from the beginning.
Yeah.
And I feel like you can draw a line of malfeasance to the present day. And I'm just curious, is there an ultimate goal that the founders had in mind with America?
I think we are the ultimate goal, right? We're moving right towards what they wanted, which was a completely controlled society.
Okay.
Well, I mean, I really believe that the sorting of... Look, America, we were just talking about, because there's a book out there called White Cargo. It's the lost history of English slavery in America, English white slavery in America. White slavery was the first slavery in America, everybody.
Right.
Before African slavery, it was white slavery. It was the Transportation Acts of the 17th century. After Queen Elizabeth beat the Spanish Armada, that's the daughter of King Henry VIII, she made a victory lap around the realm to show everybody, yeah, we're cool. She came back to her council and reported all the paupers in the streets of England. This place is rife with paupers. What's going on around here, you know? It's because her father shut down all the abbeys, monasteries, and all the places where poor people used to actually get some kind of help back in the day, you know, in the ancient times there. But they didn't replace it with anything. They just took over the manors and set up lords and let the poor fend for themselves in the streets. So they set up the Transportation Acts, which basically first thing they did was they just established what a real trade was. Unless you were a tinker or a tool or whatever, you're not really employed, and therefore you're eligible to be convicted of a felony and transported to the colonies to work, you know, like the Chesapeake tobacco farms, you know, and fight off Algonquins and bugs that have typhoid. So that's how it started. America was founded by slaves being brought in to work the fields. And then you were told, okay, they had this head rights campaign. If you agreed to be indentured and sail over to America, we'll give you 500 acres of land, right? But it'll cost you 600 acres of land to make the trip. So you'll owe the guy on the captain of the boat 100 acres of land. Don't worry. You can work that off for the next 15 years, if you survive. And when we're done with you, we'll cut you loose with a half an acre, you can homestead. But most people died within the first couple of years anyway, so that didn't even matter. But the guy who was like the diehard who made it through, the Bruce Willis, and ended up with his own little homestead, or the Russell Crowe or whatever, so now he's like on his little homestead, fighting off the Algonquin all by himself. What's he gonna do now? So they went to the brothels in England, and they emptied out all the brothels and put them on these ships and called them maiden voyages. and he sailed them over to the Americas, and they parked him in the Chesapeake, and they said, hey, Russell, you want a wife? A couple shillings, and we'll throw in a 10-year-old boy, too, as a son to work your fields. But that's like civil rights in America. You know, that's, you wonder why people viewed women and children as possessions? Because they were. They actually bought these things, you know, bought these people and brought them in to, you know, populate their farm or whatever.
Human resources.
Yeah, human resources. Yeah. So that's how America was founded. And the English kept transporting criminals to America until 1790 during the Revolution, when we shut down the borders and said no more, and that's how they founded New Zealand and Australia. Yes.
Do you have a theory about what the force was that separated man from divine consciousness? I mean, where did this? Do you think there was a starting point? I mean, I know
it's a big one.
It's a huge one. You talked about biblical stories, and I'm thinking of the creation story and. The Bible talks about the fall of man as when Adam and Eve ate from the fruit of the tree of knowledge.
The mind didn't arise.
Yeah, exactly. So I wanted to just ask you about your thoughts on that. I mean, where was there a starting point for the separation from our true selves?
Well, I think that humanity is way older than we're told. So I don't think creation began in the garden with Adam and Eve.
Right.
I think that the current paradigm that we're supposed to embrace, mm-hmm. the current timeline says that's where we began.
Mm-hmm.
But I believe that humanity began probably hundreds of thousands of years ago,
sure.
and that we've been wiped out several times along the way, and every time we get wiped out, we completely forget, and we completely do it all over again.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason why this time, like the builders, you know, people are like, what's up with the masons? What's all the buildings? What's the craftsmen? Why are we so focused on this stuff? Well, the last flood wiped out all the buildings. So who's the most important people? The people who can build stuff. You know, they're the ones that ended up in the high priesthood classes because they knew how to reconstruct. You know, they used the mud of the flood to build the new buildings. So it was like, that's why they became such a focal point, you know, and why sacred divine symmetry, you know, and how it's like order and form, and it's an expression of the divine. But to get back to your question, I think that free will and intent is the separation between consciousness, divine, and individual. We want this. We chose this. That's what I think. I think that somewhere along the way, we chose to divide, to experience. I was quoting Isaiah. I didn't get to finish the quote. Isaiah 49 says, I created the darkness and the light so that you will know that I am the Lord God. I created good and evil. It says that in the Bible. I created good and evil, whatever translation you want to go to.
Which means he's good and evil.
Which means that this whole game is called duality. You know, you can't know up without knowing down. You can't know pleasure without feeling pain. You can't know light without knowing darkness.
Right.
So that's the name of this game. It's called duality. We're a part of it. And we function within this space-time continuum using that as our parameters. But there are constants like, you know, gravity or thermodynamics. You jump off that, you're going to fall. You put your hand in the fire, it's going to burn. But there are other things that aren't so constant. And that's where we get into what this lady was talking about as far as like the unchecked technologies and what can be done to, just because you can do a thing doesn't mean it's right. Just because you can destroy a spider web with one swift pass of your hand doesn't mean you should do that. And it doesn't mean that spider web is inferior either. That spider web is an elegant construction, but it's very tender and very precious. So it can be destroyed, but it's still effective to the spider. So that's like my analogy for the tribal ways of humanity. Just because we can wipe them out with technology doesn't mean that they were inferior. It doesn't mean they weren't useful, the ways that people used to live in.
Well, they might have been superior, and they were trying to steal their technology, their understandings, their knowledge. I mean, I believe that is what a lot of that has all been about. I mean, why were the libraries of Alexandria and other great institutions of stored knowledge destroyed? Catholics never allowed to read the Bible?
That example is disputed.
That's what?
That particular example of the Library of Alexandria.
Yes.
That he was actually such a scholar and such a head freak that they think perhaps he didn't destroy it.
Who's he?
Who was
Alexander
the head freak?
Alexander the
Great. Oh, really?
Yeah.
Huh.
It's out there. It's a theory.
So,
although there was plenty of destruction, but at this point, someone said, "Well, maybe that just because he was such a scholar, taught by scholars.
Yeah, he was taught by Aristotle. That was his.
Right.
Was
a, but it's just a
tutor. So, anyways, if anybody's interested in our media, it's here. I think we're closing at 9, so you know, if any other questions, please feel free to ask me or my wife, Major X. Everybody, please get a flyer too and check out our show on Saturday nights. It's not a live broadcast anymore; it's a podcast. But we release a new one every Saturday night. So we'll record during the week and then we'll release it. And we have a chat room. We'll be in the chat room. So that during the show, while we're all listening to us talk, we'll be in the chat room too, like interacting with people who show up. It's kind of fun, actually. But I really want to thank everybody for coming. And yeah. Oh yeah, wait, one more thing. You want to read that poem still? Come on. My wife wants to read a poem to you all before you leave.
Art.
Yes,
art.
It's in there. Oh no, it's in the computer bag.
Bear with me, I'm not really a great public speaker. And you all may have heard the first two lines of this poem, and I'm really not sure of the author's intent when he wrote it over 100 years ago, but to me it represents kind of like an anthem to personal and social change. And this is by Arthur O'Shaughnessy. The poem is called Ode. We are the music makers. And we are the dreamers of dreams, wandering by lone sea breakers and sitting by desolate streams. World losers and world forsakers on whom the pale moon gleams, yet we are the movers and shakers of the world forever, it seems. With wonderful deathless ditties, we build up the world's great cities, and out of a fabulous story, we fashion an empire's glory. One man with a dream of pleasure shall go forth and conquer a crown, and three with a new song's measure can trample an empire down. We in the ages of dying, in the buried past of the earth, built Nineveh with our sighing and Babel itself with our mirth, and overthrew them with prophesying to the old of a new world's worth. For each age is a dream that is dying, or one that is coming to birth.
Well, it's not in the Bible. It's left out.
Oh, you know what? I'm sorry.